My name's Graham Watt. I'm Professor of General Practice at the University of Glasgow. My title of my talk is Reimagining the NHS, Learning from General Practice at the Deep End. The context is the challenges the NHS faces in terms of dealing with an ageing, multi-morbid population. There are big questions to ask about the balance of generalist and specialist care, where power and resource reside. Is the NHS to be a business that makes profit? Is it to be a public utility that keeps its customers satisfied? Or is it to be something more ambitious, a social institution based on mutuality and trust? I'll be drawing on examples and experience from GPs at the Deep End to make suggestions as to the issues we need to address to not only to protect the NHS, but to reimagine it as the answer to our future problems. Thank you very much, James. James is definitely the best tennis player I know. It was a nice award to get because it was an award from GPs. You know, there was once outside a pub in Sockley Hall Street, a notice on a blackboard, and a pub quiz tonight, and someone had written beneath it, "No smart arses." And that really captures my operating environment. So to end up getting that was an award that I was very pleased to get. That Frida Kahlo article, Alec Logan, the deputy editor, told me was the second most downloaded article that year, but it doesn't count for any research assessment exercises. So here we go. This is my last talk before retirement, wearing a tie. And thank you very much for the invitation. I'm going to cover quite a lot of ground. When you see this green star, it means that I think I'm saying something important. Just in case it's not obvious at the time, but of course you'll be the judge of that. So, Robert Graves, Professor of Poetry at Oxford. On his passport, under occupation, he put professor rather than poet, saying that this avoided trouble and guaranteed dull respect. Graves was a First World War poet who survived 4 years in the trenches, unlike some others. And by that time, as he said in his autobiography, Goodbye to All That, the frontline troops had only contempt for the priests and chaplains who tried to put a gloss or higher purpose on futility. The soldiers' experience of cruel fate and blind chance had left them with only one remaining value, loyalty to colleagues. They were in it together. Something that's not an original sentiment. It's easier to approve in principle than to demonstrate in practice. But demonstrate it our parents and grandparents did after World War II in the creation of the National Health Service, following Bevan's call that illness should be neither an indulgence for which people have to pay nor an offence for which they should be penalised, but a misfortune, the cost of which should be shared by the community. Bevan only wrote one book. It was called In Place of Fear, and it succinctly captured what the NHS was set up to do, to remove the fear of the consequence of illness. And that fear is still sometimes with us. Few things bring people out onto the streets. You know, anger at an illegal war, joy at a local football team winning a cup, and fear caused by any plan to close a hospital. But in the latter case, it's an irrational, misinformed fear. Hospitals are the last resort. They're expensive to stay in. They shouldn't be the first point of contact. We should make less use of them. But of course, that means having policies that reduce, delay, or avoid our need for hospital care. And I'll come on to that in just a minute. But first I want to deal with a couple of distractions. The first one is this. Let's be clear that the NHS hasn't failed. In this independent review of 11 rich countries by the Commonwealth Foundation in New York, which has nothing to do with the British Commonwealth, the NHS ranked first on almost every quality indicator, second column from the right. While the US, furthest on the right, came last. Yet the NHS spent least on healthcare per head after Norway, while the US spends most by a country mile. The NHS is under pressure, but the pressure comes from underfunding, not the lack of US-style corporate healthcare. And as the vultures gather, as they always do, because healthcare is a lucrative business if you can hoodwink the worried well and exclude people who can't pay, we may need to decide, as our parents and grandparents did, whether healthcare is a commercial business to make profits, a public utility keeping customers satisfied, or a social institution based on mutuality and trust. It's complicated because the NHS and our experience of it involves many different things for ourselves and our families, dealing with emergencies, both big and small, providing access to specialist diagnosis and treatment, getting a good start in life, dying in comfort and with dignity, and increasingly, living well with long-term conditions. The second distraction is the false promise of genetic-based so-called precision medicine. I don't doubt that this can do fantastic things for selected patients, but we're a long way from having the epidemiological information that we need to tell us whether these interventions can improve public health. And to put it simply, drawing on Roald Dahl, in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, there were only 5 golden tickets. How many golden tickets will precision medicine provide? That remains to be proven. Now, to set the scene for the first part of my talk, I'm going to borrow data from Helene Irvin. I didn't actually see Helene in the audience, although she was down to attend. So she's not here, thank goodness for that. I can speak with freedom using her data. I don't mean that. She seems to have become an alternative one-man ISD for NHS Scotland, which raises lots of issues. But here we are, top left. General practice funding in blue, where are we? Fell by a sixth in the last 10 years, whilst funding for community health services increased 46% in pink. It's not blue, it's green. But you can see the differential funding pathways of general practice and community health services top left. Top right, while GP numbers in orange have largely flatlined, and the numbers are uncertain recently, medical staffing in hospital and community services in blue increased 60%. Bottom left, these are Helene's data, district nursing was slashed in the noughties, then rallied, but is still 40% below its previous capacity. Bottom right, the consequences since 2005, an acceleration of emergency hospital admissions, which hasn't stopped and is not fully explained by the aging population. Many possible explanations for that, including the weakening of district nursing, the council tax freeze and its knock-on effects on community care, but also the weakening of general practice. If the balance of care shifts from 87% in the community and 13% in hospitals to 84% and 16%, that difference is imperceptible in primary care, but overwhelming in hospitals. The answer to that problem isn't more hospital resources. Unbelievably, as recently as September, the Scottish Government was suggesting that hospital pressures could be addressed by getting GPs to work in hospitals. Amazing. You know, when a vehicle or an organisation becomes unbalanced or lopsided, the danger is that it will capsize. And the challenge facing us, and it's a real challenge, is to correct that imbalance before it's too late. It's the gatekeeping role of general practice that keeps the NHS afloat or in balance, keeping most care in the community. For emergency services, there isn't a gate, just a gateway that patients can go through at any time to out-of-hours A&E or an acute hospital bed. What stops patients going through the gateway is satisfaction with the care that they receive and the avoidance of complications. As Barbara Starfield points out, the main contribution of healthcare is to reduce the severity of established conditions, to delay their progression, thereby preventing, postponing, or lessening complications. Now, of course, there are social determinants of health which operate outside the NHS, which need to be addressed to prevent health inequalities in the long term. But this is an important neglected social determinant of health which operates in the short term and affects people we know. Complications are avoided partly by the delivery of evidence-based medicine, but that doesn't go broadly enough. It's also and equally important that it's achieved via unconditional, personalised continuity of care for all patients, whatever condition or combination of conditions they have. Decisions are only sometimes informed by evidence. Usually they're based on experience, they're always underpinned by values. So yes, we should produce evidence wherever we can, but we also have to draw on experience and to appreciate and express the values. I spent a day shadowing a GP in Scotland's most deprived general practice. She started at 7 and she finished at 7. When she said she picked me up at 7 o'clock in the morning, I tried to give the impression that I always left the house at 7 o'clock in the morning, unlike her. So I saw endemic multimorbidity and social complexity. I saw the importance of previous encounters and shared knowledge for anything much to be achieved in a short consultation. I saw the value of empathy and trust. I didn't see any worried well patients. I did see a worried doctor, taking it upon herself to anticipate problems and take avoiding action. She set the bar high, possibly too high. Every patient mattered. But that was just one day in the life of a GP. At Govan Health Centre, these three GPs have 60 years' experience of one community between them. What might they have achieved in thousands of days throughout their professional lifetimes? When they retire, and one has retired, it's the equivalent of the Wall Street crash. All that capital built up over the years in terms of knowledge, experience, and trust disappears. We need to value and protect that capital. In life, as in the film, nothing very much happens in brief encounters. That's the reaction of young people watching that film today. Why didn't Trevor Howard get on with it? It's the serial encounter that matters, that makes the difference. All the contacts strung together with starts, stops, restarts, diversions, events, successes, failures, but underlying it all, consistent direction. There may be elements of continuity, but the serial encounter has more to it than continuity with individual professions. As Judah Hart put it, initially face-to-face, eventually side-by-side. In deprived areas, self-help and self-management are destinations, not starting points. What the unworried, unwell need, at least to begin with, is a worried doctor to steer the course, facilitate access, and anticipate hazards. In Tales of the Arabian Nights, Scheherazade made how to make up a new story every day her life depended on it. That's the business of general practice, making up, helping patients make up thousands of stories, building knowledge and confidence, helping patients live with their conditions and to avoid the complications of their conditions. Not every patient needs that. But the 10% of patients in Scotland with four or more conditions, who account for a third of all unplanned emergency admissions to hospital, and a half of all potentially preventable unplanned conditions certainly do. Now, so far I've said nothing about reimagining the NHS. It needs to be rescued first from its current calamity after a decade of preferential investment in specialist services, in primary and secondary care, weakening general practice, its ability to keep patients in the community. The problems of GP recruitment and retention are symptoms of this massive own goal. I want to leave that and to look ahead. My PhD student, Brianna Babel from Oregon, just gone back to the States, having got her degree last week, a victim of the visa requirements, otherwise she would have stayed. She interviewed 24 GPs working in very deprived areas, asking them what they thought their role could be. And some saw no further than the conventional medical model. Others broadened the consultation to include social and maybe financial issues. Others looked outside the consultation room to the practice team. Others looked outside the practice to the local community and what could be achieved in partnership, whilst others took advocacy positions, trying to influence local and national policies, engaging with managers and politicians. All of that is possible, but only if GPs have the interest, time and support enabling them to do it. Take advocacy, for example. As Henry Sigaris, the professor of history of medicine at Johns Hopkins, put it, the practitioners of a distressed area are the natural advocates of people. They well know the factors that paralyze all their efforts. They're not only scientists, but responsible citizens. And if they didn't raise their voices, who else should? A role that's exemplified by several deep end reports on the havoc being wrought by changes to the welfare benefit system. These reports, based on the recent experience of practitioners and patients, had huge authority and travelled fast. My daughter, Nulawat, who's got cerebral palsy and a PhD and gets DLA and sometimes ESA, is also involved in advocacy. And she says to the DWP, "Please stop calling me a customer. If I was a customer, I would take my custom elsewhere and write terrible reviews on the internet." However, welfare benefit changes aren't the main focus of our advocacy. The elephant in the room is that if general practice makes a difference, but is delivered inequitably, the NHS will itself widen inequalities in health. Can that be true? Well, here's a figure which divides the Scottish population into tenths, richest on the left, poorest on the right. Premature mortality in blue and complex multimorbidity in red, more than double in prevalence across the spectrum, while general practice funding per patient in black is broadly flat, especially in the deprived half of the population. And the consequences in the bottom right-hand side of the figure include GP consultations that involve more problems but are shorter and achieve less. Stuart Mercer has showed all that. Unmet need accrues and gathers, inequalities in health widen. Because general practice is less able to cope, patients are more likely to access emergency services, hospitals feel the pressure. This is quite separate from the recent problem of underfunding that Helene Irvin describes. It's an endemic historic problem that affects deprived areas, most of which are in Glasgow. Judah Hart's inverse care law described how the availability of good medical care tends to vary inversely with the need for it in the population served. But it's not a law, it's a man-made policy that restricts care in relation to need. And it's not about bad care in poor areas. Rather, it's the difference between what practices can do and could do if they were better resourced. People think that because the NHS deals with emergencies in an equitable way and is seen at its best in dealing with emergencies, that it does so for everything. But that's not the case with access to specialists, nor with ordinary general practice. And I've yet to see this acknowledged in a Scottish Government report on health inequalities. I've yet to see it in a report by a Director of Public Health or CMO, or with one exception, the report of the Glasgow Centre. But it is quintessentially a Glasgow problem. Why don't people see it as a problem requiring urgent attention? Why isn't it prioritised? And I think there are three reasons. First, because it doesn't produce noise. You know, noise-based policy is sometimes more quicker than evidence-based policy. It doesn't produce noise from patients who have learned not to expect more. The CMO's call for realistic medicine doesn't apply here. Less noise from professional bodies serving other interests, or from politicians supposedly representing affected communities. The second reason, I think, is because despite the bluster, and you could call it conceit and self-congratulation, I think we are a conservative society. The idea that there are no conservatives in Scotland was always a misnomer. I think we are conservative and more comfortable in how things are than how they could or should be. And third, because I think many people don't know or can't imagine how general practice makes a difference. And that's partly because the experience of professional and managerial people of general practice is of small problems infrequently, not multiple problems on a serial basis, as I'll show. The NHS needs to be at its best where it's needed most, otherwise inequalities will widen. Everyone can agree with that. There's no prizes for agreeing with that. But as Tudor Hart also said, intellectual opposition to injustice is only the beginning of social understanding. When the research paper that, well, the figure that I showed you was published actually just over a year ago, First Minister Nicola Sturgeon and Cabinet Secretary for Health Shona Robertson both said in the Parliament that they expect the needs of deprived areas to be addressed via the new revised GP contract. I'm not sure that's going to happen. We'll see. And I'm going to say no more about the inverse care law from now on. It used to be that a single-handed GP knew everything and did everything, like Dr. Ciriani celebrated in this life photo essay years ago in Kremlin, Colorado. No more. The intrinsic features of general practice on the left, patient contact, population coverage, continuity, flexibility, long-term relationships and trust are essential. They make general practice the natural hub of local health systems. No other part of the public service has these characteristics in such large measure. I'm not talking about the goodness or badness of GPs, I'm talking about the structure of the system and what it offers. But although essential, it's not sufficient, because of the need for links to a host of other resources and services. Consider this, two professionals might work in the same community. On the collaboration ladder, zero means they've never heard of each other. One means they've heard of each other but have never met. Two means they've met but they don't meet, they don't work together. Three means they work together haphazardly. Four means they sit round a table to review and plan joint work. Very little use has been made of data and metric such as these. We simply don't know in most local health systems where they stand. Local health systems can be resource poor, but people rich. Think of Cuba. Whatever you think of the politics of Cuba, their achievements in health and education are huge. Or resource rich and people poor. Think of the United States. Who knows where our local health systems measure on that scale? Remember the day 50 years ago when Celtic became the first British team to win the European Cup, doing so with 11 players, none of whom had been born more than 30 miles from Glasgow. Or when Alex Ferguson's Aberdeen team beat Real Madrid in the European Cup Winners' Cup in 1983, they were the last team to win a European competition with players all from the same country. I realized when drawing attention to these examples recently that I need to point out this is not to argue against immigration. It's to show that local people can do extraordinary things if they work together and believe in what they are doing. Neither Jock Stein nor Alex Ferguson scored goals, defended well, or saved penalties, but they knew how to get other people to do that. So I'm closing the first part of my talk with the need for a building program. And thank goodness it's not a bricks and mortar program. We've had that. This is based on relationships, building patient narratives on the one hand, building better relationships with colleagues and services on the other. The figure I showed you has been turned upside down top left. It gives the swimming pool with a deep and shallow end, hence general practitioners at the deep end, not getting to the bottom of problems. Then our logo, and bottom right, an intrepid pair of deep end GPs in Postle Park, Glasgow. You can probably tell that it's an artificial picture because behind the photographer there's a lamp illuminating them. And behind the lamp there's a minder making sure that the lamp is not being pinched by the local youths. But it appeared in The Guardian and it's a great photograph. The logo shows the swimming pool, the steep gradient of need, the flat slope of resource, a sunrise or a sunset, depending how you feel, a thistle, because it's a Scottish project, although there are now deep end projects in Ireland and in Yorkshire Humber and maybe in Manchester too. There's down left hand side, there's a spirtle, which is a traditional Scottish stirring instrument. And the whole thing is a flag for rallying under. So this is quite a rich and meaningful logo, which the other places are trying to follow. When asked why he robbed banks, Willie Sutton, the American bank robber, replied it was because where the money is. And why the deep end? It's because that's where the deprivation is. Not pocket deprivation. The small numbers of deprived patients to be found in most general practices, but blanket deprivation that dominates everything a deep end practice does. Bear in mind that the inverse care law, mentioned again, applies not just in the deep end. In Scotland, over 2 million Scots, the most deprived 40%, get 10% less GP funding per head per annum, that's about 8% less, than over 3 million Scots, the most affluent 60%. So it's not just the deep end. This needs to be addressed by a pro rata funding formula. Deep end patients would benefit most, but not exclusively. In 2009, the 100 most deprived general practices in Scotland had never been convened or consulted by anybody. And now they've got identity, profile, voice, impact and increasingly shared activity. What do they have in common with Count Dracula? They only come out at night. They're otherwise engaged during the day, doing different things, admittedly. But generally speaking, GPs are systematically excluded from daytime activities and meetings because of the difficulty of getting out of practice, because somebody else has to see the patients. And at the beginning, we needed a locum budget to get colleagues out of practice to come to meetings. And if Carol Tanner was here, I would thank her again and again and again for allowing us to use some unspent grant money for that purpose. You know, if we'd ever asked anybody else for a locum budget for GPs to come to meetings, I'll leave it to your imagination what the answer would have been. But Carol gave us the flexibility to do that, and I think her trust in us has been repaid, because it has led to over 30 reports, all in short and long forms, available on our website, capturing GPs' experience and views on a range of topics as a source of important evidence in language that's jargon-free and easily understood. For example, this report on the CPD needs of GPs, identified the usual list of topics that occur most often in deprived areas at the top, but also generic issues, such as how to engage with patients who are difficult to engage, how to deal with complexity and high volume without burning out, how to apply evidence when so little of it is based on the types of patients you see. This report on mental health issues complemented local mental health services, but pointed out they left a lot for general practice to do with patients who don't fit referral criteria, who aren't good at accessing services, who have other health problems, or who are not made better by the protocols on offer. The Deep End Manifesto, issued in 2013, was report number 20. It's on the website. It argued for six things: extra time to address unmet need, better use of serial encounters to build patient narratives, general practices as the natural hubs of local systems because of their contact coverage and continuity, better connections across the front line for shared learning, better support from central organisations, many of which have a very low profile in deprived areas, and stronger leadership at every level, sharing power, resource and responsibility. And I'm going on now to describe four projects which give expression to these aims, all of which have been funded by central government, not by the local NHS. The recently published Care Plus study involved 152 patients in eight deep end practices in a randomised controlled trial of extra consultation time for complex patients, plus support for practitioners and patients, about an hour extra per patient per year, not a huge amount, which the GPs spent mostly on a long initial encounter. And after a year, quality of life was higher in the intervention group on the left, not so much because it improved in this group as because it got worse in those not getting the intervention on the right. This intervention of giving patients longer time with a long initial encounter slowed decline, which means that complications were occurring less often, which is a crucial observation on what healthcare can achieve. It was also cost-effective, a cost-effective use of NHS resources, coming well below the NICE threshold. If this was a drug or a technology, we think it would be funded and sail into policy without question, but because it's extra time for consultations in general practice, the path is much less certain. The Link Worker Programme. Now that's embedded a full-time community links practitioner in seven deep end practices. They do several things. They connect with community resources. They help patients who need help to access those resources. They can provide one-to-one serial encounters. But when link workers are also involved in helping patients floundering between dysfunctional and fragmented healthcare arrangements, then something else is being addressed. Expert witness Spike Milligan. This is an audience who knows who Spike Milligan is. It's not always the case. He described a man who invented a machine that did the work of two men but took three men to work it, which is modern healthcare in a nutshell. There are too many hubs or centres in the NHS doing a particular thing, often very well, with referral criteria, waiting lists to control demand, evidence-based protocols to deliver and discharge back to general practice when they're done. All that may be done well. It leaves a lot for general practice to do. And I'll say it again, for patients who don't fit the criteria, who are not good at accessing services, who have other conditions, or who are not made better by the treatment. When patients with multiple problems, which above a certain age is most people, 10 to 15 years earlier in deprived areas, when they have to attend multiple clinics, life's made more difficult through what's called the treatment burden, the work you have to do to live and understand with a condition. And what's convenient for professionals and services is often burdensome for patients. Everyone practicing patient-centered medicine, but somehow the patient isn't at the center. George Bernard Shaw described professions as conspiracies against the laity, not because they met in secret to conspire against patients, but because of their tendency and ability to arrange things as it suits them. For some patients, healthcare is a bit like a pinball machine. Link workers often help patients engage with services they need, and in doing so, they support rather than challenge dysfunctional, fragmented systems. In the deep end, patients need referral services that are quick, local, familiar, preferably via attached workers who can work flexibly according to the needs of patients and practices, not external criteria. Accepting that your problem is our problem and we will start dealing with it today. The healthcare equivalent of a machine that does the work of two men but takes only one to work it are small local teams of doctors and nurses working as generalists, unconditionally, knowing their patients well. The future of the NHS is insufficiently imagined if it doesn't address that challenge. Third example, the Govan SHIP project. SHIP stands for Social and Health Integration Partnership, but it's also based near shipyards that built the Queen Mary. This project adds clinical capacity, about 10%, to four deep end practices in the health centre via permanent locums. It releases a protected session per week for all 15 GPs. Two attached social workers, two attached link workers, support for monthly multidisciplinary teams. With the increased clinical capacity, it's perhaps the only place in Scotland that is currently addressing the inverse care law directly. And here's an audit of what 15 GPs did with their protected sessions during 2 weeks in February this year. They documented 136 activities, of which 76 were extended consultations, lasting between 20 and 40 minutes, in the surgery or at home. Or they spent time reviewing case notes with a patient not being there. And here's a sample that I don't expect you to read, but I would encourage you to access this on our website, Report 29. This is a sample of the extended consultations, all of them for complicated combinations of medical, psychological, and social problems. In one sense, they're all different. In another, they're all the same, requiring unconditional, personalized, coordinated continuity of care. And this work, driving integrated care based on the reassessment of patients' problems, needs clinical generalists who are not fazed by complexity. Nurses and pharmacists may be able to do it, but not in such large measure, especially when they work in circumscribed areas. That's not to say that work isn't important, but it's not capable of addressing this part of need. Every case is a demonstration of unmet needs, or more accurately, uncoordinated care. The consequences of the inverse care law that added clinical capacity can address. So I commend to you Deep End Report 29. And finally, the Pioneer Scheme. Six early career GPs have been appointed, attached to six Deep End practices. They have eight sessions a week. Three of them are extra clinical sessions for the practices. Three are protected sessions, backfill for protected sessions for the GPs to use as they think fit, possibly following the Govan example. And for two protected sessions a week, the fellows attend a day release course, attending their own learning needs as deep end GPs, and in doing so, producing learning materials and activities for others to use. Fellows and lead GPs will work together to develop a programme of service developments. It's a huge opportunity for these practices to show what GP-led primary care transformation can achieve, addressing issues of recruitment, retention, and new ways of working. The ball is very definitely in their court. So these are challenging times. With the underfunding of general practice, staying in the same place is hard work. The ball could easily roll downhill, might never return. There are parts of the country where that may be happening. The government's launched a programme to boost the recruitment and retention of GPs. They'd do well to recognise that the three essential ingredients of professional satisfaction, other things being in balance, are autonomy, the ability to make decisions, to fashion the future, mastery, That's a feeling of being valued for what you do and doing it well. And purpose, the sense of having a clear shared direction. In a small way, the Deep End Project is trying to achieve that. The heart of the project has been a steering group, an informal group of about 10 to 16 GP colleagues, meeting every 6 weeks or so in their own evening time. We don't usually have food and wine, but after 50 meetings, it seemed reasonable to celebrate. We've now moved to daytime quarterly meetings with locum funding for backfill. If it hadn't been for the steering group, the Deep End Project would have been just another short-term initiative trying to change general practice from the outside. We know what happens or doesn't happen. Instead, I think we've a thriving academic service partnership based on mutuality and respect. Everything has something to contribute. It's been a good start in a modest way, because only about a fifth of the 100 practices are involved in these projects. The rest are where they were 7 years ago. I think it bolsters the role of general practice. It improves the prospects for recruitment and retention. And it not only imagines the future, but is finding ways to get there. So some final closing remarks. If we don't change direction, we'll arrive where we're heading. There's no doubt about that. And the risks are real. I think there are five building challenges. And the first, as I hope I've made loud and clear, we need to bolster and develop the local generalist function. Not just GPs, but others who can do that kind of work. To deal unconditionally with multimorbidity. And metaphorically, that's a machine that does the work of two people that takes one person to work it. We have to imagine and develop such machines. Second, and this is where the green stars come home to roost, we need to start building, not only building, but measuring social capital within local health systems to know how strong they are, based on the sum of all the working relationships within them, based on where they are in the collaboration ladder or some other metric. Third, the ultimate yardstick of integrated care is the random sample of patient experience, however difficult that is to obtain. Not just satisfaction with single episodes, but whether the individual aspirations and goals are being met. Used to be listen to the patient, he's telling you the diagnosis. Now it's listen to the patient, she's telling you her treatment goals. That's a real challenge. Are patients acquiring the knowledge and confidence to live well with their conditions? Fourth, this is perhaps the most difficult, go back. Building public understanding, support and engagement in what we're trying to do. Not in an abstract way or via small numbers of representatives on official organizations, but for example, through the experience of the relatives of elderly people. Do they then become advocates or critics of the system? So that instead of public outrage at proposals to change hospital services, we might have public support for arrangements in the community, reducing, delaying, or even avoiding the need to be admitted to hospital. And fifth, that can't be achieved by a centrally managed organization that sees itself as a public utility, keeping its customers satisfied. The goal has to be a social institution based on mutuality and trust for which everyone is responsible. And to do that, we're going to need help from powerful people because they control resources, but there are real limits to their power to change. Also clever people, who I think are often not as clever as people think. But mostly this work can only be done locally by streetwise people who have contact and relationships with local communities. In the deep end, we learned from the Bridge Project, which attempted to link practices, knowledge of elderly patients to community resources for physical and social activity. There was no blueprint that could be rolled out. Each locality needed to find its own solutions by trial and error. It's not, as Spock used to say to Captain Kirk, that human behavior is illogical. It's that the logic is only apparent in local terms. You can review what local teams, you can review where they've got to, but you can't tell them how to get there, because only they have the intelligence and knowledge to make those choices. And of course, that's a recipe for chaos. Unless everyone is connected voluntarily, I think, in a coalition of learning, sharing experience, knowledge, information, evidence, and values, so that the best anywhere becomes the standard everywhere. We need infrastructures to support that process. And it will need imagination to provide it, not just the practical arrangements, but also the culture of mutual responsibility and shared learning. And as the Glasgow Centre for Population Health considers its next programme of work, perhaps there's work for it and a role here. We may not know the destination, and we do know the direction of travel. And as Robert Louis Stevenson put it, it's better to travel hopefully than to arrive. And people forget to say that the true success is to labour, providing you're on the right road. Thank you for listening.